We've added a few syllables to a chronic issue in American society by calling it income inequality. It does sound a bit less harsh than being poor. You can work 40 hours a week and work hard and still be poor. That's the kind of life we get to experience close up in a new book by Sarah Smarsh called Heartland, a memoir of working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth. Sarah introduces us to her own family and friends, along with a broader analysis of why people can work hard, save what they can, and still lose ground financially. Sarah Smarsh is a former professor of nonfiction writing and a frequent speaker on economic inequality and its related issues. She has covered these issues for the likes of The Guardian and Harper's and The New Yorker Online. Sarah lives in Kansas. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
So the heartland of the title immediately makes sense. You lived this as well as studied it.
I sure did. I grew up on a wheat and cattle farm about 30 miles west of Wichita, Kansas, kind of a flat, expansive prairie that my family farmed for five generations. And I was born in 1980, which anyone who's following statistics will note is the beginning of many trends toward increasing income and wealth inequality, which we find ourselves at a historic moment of right now. And so my book basically attempts to kind of track that downward trend for working people in this country, using my family's story as kind of a springboard to a bigger conversation.
Let's come back to that 1980 point, because you do remark in the book that you were born the year the country began a sharp turn toward economic inequality. What were the elements of that sharp turn?
Well, you know, I think that as far as the rural aspect of my upbringing, which was one of the more rare components of the story in an increasingly urban country, the 1980s, of course, was when what we called the farm crisis was coming to a head. A lot of farms were underwater, and small family farms were sort of being lost to industrial agriculture. Farm aid came about that during my childhood. So that's one piece of it. It was essentially just a decades-long trend of difficulty for small family farms, due largely to corporate power in those spaces. But in a sense that is more universally relevant, and in particular to your listeners who might be in urban areas or with different experiences, that was, of course, the year that Ronald Reagan was elected. And while my book is not a political one, making any sort of over political arguments, the raw numbers do seem to bear out that the economic policies of that decade were very harsh to working people who previously had benefited from more robustly funded public programs by way of taxes on the more wealthy Americans.
This is where the phrase trickle-down economy began to be heard a lot mm-hmm. during the 1980s. And you know, one of the things that get tied up in the discussion about people who end up on different ends of the income scale is the idea of personal responsibility. And you address that angle very, very early in the book. Did your family talk about why people get poor or end up poor?
You know, there was just, I think, as is the case in many American households, absorbing the culture and society that we do, a general sense in my family, not necessarily directly articulated, but always felt that that one's outcome somehow had to do with how hard one worked. And, of course, we were working very hard as on a small farm. My dad was a construction worker. The women in my family worked in places like factories and truck stop diners and they drove tractors, too, by the way. And, you know, so somehow there was kind of a dissonance between this sort of American idea that we had in our minds about hard work being somehow related to your economic station and reward, and the reality that we were living every day, which was, I think, somehow at an even deeper level, making us suspicious of these narratives that we were told, because you know, we could see from how much money was in our bank account or the lack of funds to, say, send a kid to college, that it must not be about how hard you work or how talented you are or smart you are. My family had all those things in spades and very little to show for it.
Let's talk about some of the individuals and some of their own circumstances. Your mom, Jeannie, had lived in something like 48 places by high school. Why?
That's right. So I've focused in our conversation to some extent on the rural aspect of my upbringing, and that's by way of my father's side of the family. I'm a fifth-generation farm kid on my paternal line. My maternal line, however, is sort of a different lot and a different version of poverty. Female and more urban, or at least small town, not out in a remote countryside doing agricultural work, but rather living in mostly small Midwestern cities in decades like the 60s and 70s when my maternal grandmother was a young woman, when policy was less kind than it is to women now, and workplaces were far more prohibitive in terms of access. And so for that reason, they were suffering sort of twofold, one for their poverty, but two for their gender. And the just physical danger of that sort of life when they were at the mercy, say, of abusive men on whom they were also economically reliant meant that they had to sometimes just pull up and move for their own survival. Sometimes it was because of an eviction notice when the rent didn't get paid, but there's a million reasons why poverty can contain a real chaos, and it did for my mother's family, certainly.
Yeah, there's a whole chapter called The Body of a Poor Girl that that really gets a little further into what we were just talking about, but there are just so many details and so many facets of people's lives and understandings and how their experiences match up or don't with what the national narrative is on people who work hard and still end up poor. Mm-hmm. This is the stuff of Sarah Smarsh's book, Heartland, a memoir of working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth. We'll come back and talk more with Sarah, and you can join the conversation by phone and email when we return in a minute 20. On the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Heartland, a memoir of working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth, gives us parallel stories of individuals lovingly told, realistically though as well, about Sarah Smarsh's family growing up on the prairie in Kansas, working hard and not making a lot of economic progress. And then the other track in the story is about the larger narrative for the whole country and why it happens that people can be working very hard and staying poor in the richest country on earth. You can join the conversation on the Exchange as we talk about Heartland with Sarah, 800-838-3760 and jx@jeffnet.org. I want to go a little further into some of the personal details. You mentioned that on your paternal side, that was five generations of farm family. Your mother's side had kind of moved around into cities and smaller towns throughout the Midwest. Your mom, Jeannie, once she was in Wichita, how keen was she to join her mom on a farm with a new husband?
Yeah, so I think my mom was, Jeannie was about 14 when her wild, young, vivacious mother improbably fell in love with a farmer 30 miles west of Wichita. And as a teenager in Wichita, which might not sound like a terribly cosmopolitan place to folks on the coasts, is nonetheless the biggest city in Wichita. And I think she fancied herself a city kid. And she was not looking forward to that farm life by any means, but she was dragged west anyhow.
So it sounds like your mom's mom, Betty, got a real lesson in self-sufficiency on that farm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly. And, you know, it was a different kind of self-sufficiency. She had been taking care of herself in many ways all along, as is often the case for children born into poverty. But it is a different sort of self-reliance in a rural space, and that's because you can't run down to the corner to grab a missing ingredient when you're cooking, and you can't, holler next door when you need something. The geographic isolation of the experience means that you are going to be, there's no snow scoop from the city coming down your road or your driveway. All of this work falls to you, and her husband worked hard, and she learned how to work hard in all those very rural and agricultural ways too, which funny enough, it turned out was just really kind of her calling in some ways in terms of her sense of place. And she to this day really identifies as what she would call a country person and prefers that landscape.
So Betty thrived on the farm.
She did. Yeah, she loved it. And she could, she's sort of a matriarch within our family in terms of her caregiving and nurturing essence. And so on this farm, she was sort of able to take care of other beings, whether they were animals or family members in need. It was the first time in her life that she had a quiet, peaceful space. Now, don't get me wrong, it got quite raucous on the weekends with kegs of beer, but she was with a man who was good to her for the first time in her life, and in a place where she could just have some peace from the chaos of poverty. The farm was already owned outright, and while there still wasn't much money going around, that gave just enough breathing room for her to enjoy, like, feeding the chickens, and she loved that life.
You mentioned that that your grandmother, Betty, was young and vivacious. In fact, she was 16, I guess, when she had your mother. How typical was that in your family?
It not only was typical, but almost an assurance. And so, the best that I can figure in my research, going back as far as such things were documented, to say with the times that women wore corsets, I'm the first female in my direct maternal line to not have become a mother as a teenager. And so this was something that I sensed quite keenly as a child in some very deep ways. I might not have had the language to articulate it, but just as Betty was 16 and my mother after her was 17 when she became pregnant with me. And, this today is an aspect of that has everything to do with class. In some senses, rural and geography and just the culture of a place, but definitely has to do with something about being poor in America.
Heartland is the book by Sarah Smarsh, a memoir of working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth. So some of the details, though, about the things that were taken as natural to the lifestyle or the class or whatever the express terms would be, some of the details are really fascinating. Your mom, for example, did not breastfeed you. Why? Mm-hmm.
I was born in 1980, as we discussed earlier, and that was actually a moment when breastfeeding was very much not in fashion in mainstream culture. And so while we have seen a return and a tide back toward that very natural and healthy process, at that moment, it was considered sort of the ultimate scourge of poverty to have to, essentially not have the middle class privilege of formula. And perhaps that had some things to do with women entering the workforce in greater numbers, needing to get back to work at a time when a child might still be breastfeeding. But so somehow our family prioritized scratching together coins for formula rather than what would seemingly be the more sensible choice of breastfeeding. So it's a different moment in culture for sure.
So there was some sense of class or standing or just things that you do or don't do culturally. I mean, how much was this discussed as you grew up? I mean, anybody come out and say, we're kind of poor here, but, we get by.
That's such a good question. Just I think that the way that we regard ourselves and the language that we use to label our own identities is incredibly important in a national sense of just how we understand ourselves as a country and talk to each other. And, to be honest, I had no idea that we were poor, and I never would have dared to use that word. And the reason is, had enough to eat. There was a roof over our heads, so no complaints. That's the culture I come from. I think there's some validity to that, actually, in terms of just sheer survival. Now, what did the stuff of our life look like? 100% poverty, and by every measure, whether it be federal income or just the class and technological and material touchstones of our lives, yes, we were, as they say, in poverty. But our language for class is so lacking in this country now and certainly historically in the midst of a society that tells itself it's a meritocracy and sort of denies a class structure and the language that would be required to discuss it. I think we, like many people, would have, if called upon to find a word, we might have suggested middle class. While we were, say, living in a single-wide mobile home on a patch of dirt in rural Kansas, cutting coupons and putting bills on the refrigerator with magnets to pay them as the money allowed in order of due date. So meanwhile, some family who made $500,000 a year might have also called themselves middle class. So it's sort of a disaster the way that we have tried to talk about it, and I'm heartened by the fact that it seems that we're beginning to face this issue as a country now.
Is it a deliberate thing to deny, or is it just that we just feel more comfortable calling ourselves middle class if we don't feel super rich or don't feel super poor?
Well, I honestly think just it begins with just a lack of understanding class and how it works, and so I suppose it's not so much an overt denial as maybe just a lack of information or language. I do think, though, that, I would say in more powerful factions of the country than my own family is where I'm suggesting that there might be a more savvy denial of a system that certainly works to the benefit of those groups.
This is the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Our guest is Sarah Smarsh, a former professor of nonfiction writing, frequent speaker on economic inequality and its related issues. And she's covered these issues for several publications and now has come to a book called Heartland, a memoir of working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth. It's a conversation you're more than welcome to join and may have some experiences of your own to share with us. 800-838-3760. Get into the conversation by phone, or you can send your emails to jx@jeffnet.org. We had talked about farm aid and some of the other things going on with family farming, particularly in the 1980s. And you mentioned being born in fact, you say it's funny that both you and your brother were born weeks before elections that Reagan won. How much worse and how quickly did the economics of farming get during your early years? And how aware were you, for that matter?
Sure. Well, for us in rural Kansas, which is definitely kind of ground zero of that crisis, what I sensed as a child, you know, at that moment in the 1980s, small towns still had, you know, like a little two-room schoolhouse that had been open since the turn of the century, and maybe it was just hanging on with two teachers, but it was still there. At one point, I went to one of those schools, 33 students, K through 8,
wow.
On some red dirt, and in it, like many such small schools, consolidated with other districts during my childhood. The retail equivalent of that was, you know, when I was little, we were still going to some of the small retail shops on Main Street of small towns. By the time I was a teenager, those same places were shuttering. So it was sort of like experiencing in real time what, you know, is now often discussed in abstract terms as kind of the demise of small town America or rural flight. Those aren't new trends, and I don't mean to suggest that they're all on the shoulders of the Reagan administration. When I document my childhood, in some ways it was just decades-long trends coming to a head, and that had something to do with the Industrial Revolution and just the urbanization of our country from the start of the 20th century. But it really felt like kind of the nail being driven into the coffin in some ways at that moment, and it felt, you know, seeing the communities around me falter in some heartbreaking ways, and none more heartbreaking than the sale of the family farm, which is something that we also experienced. Created a sense of being growing in a place that was simultaneously economically dying, and that was, it was all I knew. So I wasn't exactly examining it in such a way in at the time as it was lived. But I now understand that was, to receive signals that your place and the place that you love and might also be encouraged to, quote unquote, get out of, and even if you don't want to, was a harsh environment to come up in.
You talked about harsh environments in other senses. I mentioned the chapter called The Body of a Poor Girl, which is fairly astonishing. I mean, in your eyes, what value does society place on that body?
Well, you know, I talk in the book about how, well, first let me begin by saying I think that in our conversations about the working class, they too often default to white stories, and mine is one of those, of course, and it's the one that I have to offer. I hope it has some validity in the broader conversation. I would never claim that it speaks for the whole working class, however. And I think our conversations also too often default to male stories. So, you know, let's say a conservative man in Appalachia who works in the coal mines. This has become kind of in popular culture and even a well-intentioned news media, the signifier for the working class. And the working class I know is diverse in every way, racially, ethnically, in terms of gender, politics, ideologies, religion. And so I'm careful to put a spotlight on female stories in my family. I'm one of them, of course, but in that chapter I'm talking about the specific challenges that are faced if one is poor and female. And the thing about that experience is you are, just like your male counterpart, valued for the physical labor of your body. So the women who raised me, you know, did manual labor just like men did. But on top of that, you are also the potential bearer of children, and that's true of women in any class, of course, but it is a complicated aspect to carry physically when one is in poverty, because being poor makes motherhood harder, and motherhood makes being poor harder. And then on top of that, you've got just a sexist society in which a body is a decorative object or just sort of objectified in ways that can be harmful psychologically, economically, and even physically, of course, as we are now discussing as a nation the ways in which women's bodies are vulnerable. So any vulnerability that a female body experiences in this world is more keenly felt and more sharply dangerous in the context of poverty.
You'd mentioned earlier, Sarah, about your grandmother, Betty, and how settling on the farm in Kansas got her for the first time with a guy who wasn't physically abusive. I mean, how old were you when you learned these stories about women and physical abuse in your part of the world?
Yeah, it's such a good question, because I've written a book about these folks, and because I'm talking to you openly about it now, it might suggest I come from a culture where everyone's going around reflecting on the past and dissecting their own lives, and this is certainly not the case at all. I'm from a German Catholic Midwestern rural, very stoic culture, and while you know a lot of laughs and joy in the midst, one is not encouraged to reflect on the past or talk about let's say feelings, and so really I think just the kind of future journalist in me and just my disposition as a kid had me always rooting around where I wasn't supposed to be rooting. So I was opening drawers and digging through old photos, asking questions when the adults had had too much beer and I thought that they might give me some straight answers for a change. And so I was just kind of trying to piece together what I could sense were these painful aspects of our family history. You know, in the meantime, I was also seeing, you know, kind of around corners, women in other households of our family get counsel from my grandma about a physical altercation at the hands of their male spouse or partner. I was fortunate to grow up in households where the men were not violent. That was unfortunately not the case for most of the women in my family.
So many ways to go here. There's a lovely vignette in here of a younger you singing along to Trashy Women on the car radio. Mm. And how did your mom react?
Yeah, so this song came out, I think, in the early 90s, and it's a catchy ditty that was a hit on pop country radio, which we listen to often, about this man is telling this story about how he's attracted to it. As you said, the title of the song, Trashy Women. So he tells a tale. He's from a sophisticated background and household. He likes, hard up waitresses with wearing too much makeup, with big hair or whatever. And you know, it's a not only sexist but also horribly classist song. And I didn't understand that as a kid. Of course, I just thought it had a good beat and it was a catchy song, and I sang along to the words, not really understanding what they meant. And my mom changed, you know, moved the dial on the car radio and said, don't sing that song. And that memory always stuck with me. You know, sometimes these experiences, they burn themselves onto our psyches, and we don't understand their significance until much later. So why would I remember such a seemingly arbitrary moment so acutely? And I certainly understand why now, is that my mother didn't want me to receive those sorts of messages about who we were as females.
A lot of lessons to learn here, and it's just a fascinating story that's told both from your own perspective and the perspective of members of your family, and then we get the macro view, too, which I want to get into in the next segment. The book is called Heartland, A Memoir of Working Hard and Being Broke in the Richest Country on Earth. Sarah Smarsh, its author, our guest. Welcome back to talk more with Sarah and take phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to join us and share your own stories and experiences or just ask some questions of our guest. 800-838-3760 by phone. Emails to jx@jeffnet.org. And we'll be back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Sarah Smarsh, a former professor of nonfiction writing, frequent speaker on economic inequality and related issues. She's covered the issues as a journalist and then written a book recently called Heartland, a memoir of working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth. And yes, that would be this country, and Heartland does refer to Kansas in this sense. You can join us on the exchange with your own stories or your questions for our guest at 800-838-3760 by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. I've largely focused on the women in your family. They are a fascinating story together and individually as well. I want to talk a little more about your father here, though, who was from the fifth generation farm family, but did other jobs as well, as you mentioned. What happened to him while he was working for a toxic waste disposal company?
Yeah, so in addition to his farm work and also lifelong construction work, he, to get by, needed to take a third job. And so his position had him essentially driving a work van around to industrial waste sites and picking up spent chemicals, like maybe oil after an oil change. And then his mission was to take this to some EPA-designated site for legal disposal. And just his first week on the job, due to apparently faulty equipment and lack of safety standards on the part of a billion-dollar corporation that owned that van, he was inhaled fumes from the chemicals that were sloshing around, mixing in bad ways in the back of the van, and it almost killed him. He was hospitalized for weeks and for several years after that. I was about 8 years old when this happened. I had what they call toxic psychosis. So essentially, his brain function was severely harmed by that exposure to chemicals. And he did ultimately fully recover, but it was, as you can imagine, a hugely tragic event for our family.
So, which raises the question for the family is if it ever got to a spoken sense of hopelessness, a spoken recognition that people had to keep working in difficult circumstances to make sure that there was still food on the table.
Mm. You know, I can't remember anyone ever using the language of hopelessness or sort of what we might call admitting defeat. And I think that just might be a psychological function of the experience, which requires, you know, if you are going to get up and keep going with your life and put one foot in front of the other, you're going to have to tell yourself that there is some level of hope for a better moment. And so, I don't think that anyone said, you know, I give up, this is hopeless, where the cards are too stacked against us. When you bring up this moment of my father's workplace injury, not long after that, his father passed away. He and my mother divorced. We sold the house that he had built with his own hands. That was kind of his dream out in the country. And it was also a slow period for the construction industry, so he was struggling financially. All of those things happened within like 2 years. Mm-hmm. And so I talk in the book about how those circumstances certainly affected my dad's just how he presented in terms of his personality in those moments. His spirit would kind of flicker in and out, where he's usually an overwhelmingly upbeat guy. He was quite beaten down in those times.
And what were the things, what were the elements in your life that allowed you to depart from that path, to not be in Kansas, to not be, well, you mentioned coming to a recognition, I think fairly young, that you were not going to join the ranks of women in your family who had born children as teenagers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. First let me say, I live in Wichita now, and I choose to make my home there, and I love my place. What I always wanted to, as I say, get out of was the more kind of amorphous experience of poverty. And of course, I have lived in other places like New York and Kansas City, but I returned to my home. The way that I, you know, ended up with different economic outcomes than my family, perhaps, or my place and class, I think maybe had something to do with my powers of observation as a child, and that maybe was just the future writer in me. It's seems to just be how I came into the world as someone who's always looking around, scanning an environment. There is a hypervigilance that is required of any kid in an environment where there's a lot of alcohol or abuse, as was the case in my broader upbringing. But I think beyond that, my personality is curious always, and so looking around at this, you know, what we might call a cast of characters around me, which for me was my beloved family, I could discern patterns. The not finishing of high school, the teenage pregnancy, the addiction to some substance or another. If I want things to look different in my life, then maybe I should endeavor to do the opposite of all of those things. And so I did have, believe it or not, a very conscious mission statement along those lines, as even, say, a teenager who knew that if I was going to get to, say, go to college, I was going to have to get straight A's for the scholarships to get there. So it required, a very thoughtful, almost tactical approach to my own life, and I think that's probably part of it.
Sarah Smarsh, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is called Heartland. Here's a phone call from Peter in Siskiyou County. Thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning, sir. Glad to have you back.
Thank you. Good to be here.
You know what? Ranching, farming is a tough way of life. You never make any money. If you want to make a small fortune, start with a large one and work your way down. But one thing that you can get out of it is knowledge. Nobody can take knowledge away from you. Mm. It's, you know, we have, under my watch, we have multiple acres. And it's grown. And yeah, there's times that you look at a package of Top Ramen and wonder if you can get two meals or three out of it.
Wow.
But you don't have to go to a grocery store to get anything you need.
Huh.
So, you know, it's tough. It's really tough. But it makes tough people.
Mm.
And that's the kind of people that this country relies on. So,
all right, Peter.
I appreciate all the input from your guest, and you know what? I wouldn't trade this life for anything.
All right. Thank you so much, Peter, which is exactly what you said, Sarah. I mean, you wouldn't want to give this life to anybody else, but you wouldn't trade it in either.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. I have just immense gratitude for the gifts that kind of came along with the good and the bad of my upbringing. And I tried in the book to, while you and I are focusing on the woes of poverty and the working poor, in the book I tried to make sure and paint a bigger portrait that includes joy and fun and laughter and freedom, and I had all those things too along the way.
I was very clear from the very early part of the book too. I was telling my wife that I was impressed by the warmth that you showed toward the members of your family, not surprisingly, I guess, and you really get that picture painted. But I do want to take the discussion more macro here.
Mm.
Among other things, you take exception, Sarah, to people thinking of white working people as a monolith. What do you mm-hmm. see as the major flaw in that thinking?
Yeah. Well, you know, I actually started this book some 15 years ago. I got my first research grants in 2002 when I was a senior in college. And so my answer to this question would have been quite different then. At that moment, which is sort of a lifetime ago in American politics, my great grievance would have been that, well, really just a sense of invisibility for the people that I come from in the news media or popular culture. And then when we were portrayed somewhere, to me it seemed always some sort of caricature or stereotype of, you know, like a buck-toothed hillbilly who's ignorant and dumb and backwards in every social way. I don't think that that portrayal has changed all that much, but now it has a very clear political layer to it in our post-2016 moment, where we're talking about class in some reductive ways as relate to voting behavior. And so today my great grievance is that the portrayal seems to be no longer is it just dumb, but like, let's say dumb and extremely conservative. The people who raised me don't fit either one of those criteria, and it is frustrating to always be held up as sort of the image of, let's say, the Trump base or the rural conservative America. That place is not a monolith in any way, and that includes politics.
Does anybody benefit from people being wrong about the white working class?
Well, the best that I can estimate is the reason that such erroneous narratives persist in the face of just raw data that tell us things like white people at every economic rung voted for Donald Trump at the same rate. Nonetheless, this fixation on the working class within the white demographic, which, by the way, tends to be done by, I would say, upper middle class and upper class white people who live in privileged places and set the narratives for this country as members of the media. The best I can figure is that fixation kind of deflects responsibility for our current political moment from the most powerful people among us. And this is by no means an apologist for voting behavior within the working class or among quote-unquote poor whites, but it is important, I think, for us to tell the whole conversation and not scapegoat one group for what ultimately is the behavior of other groups that have more economic power and agency in this country.
You know, it takes a whole lot of people and a whole lot of power and a whole lot of money to put people in office.
Yes.
You wrote over the summer, Sarah, about your dad having more in common with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the Democratic Socialist from New York, than with the right Republicans who run Kansas. What does your father share with her?
Yeah, you know, she and fellow Democratic Socialist Bernie Sanders came to Wichita, where I live, over the summer. Had on a weekday a turnout of something like 4,000 or 5,000 people, and just a raucous crowd in a midterm election year of all things. And I think a kind of overlooked story of the kind of place that I'm from is a leftist populism. That term populism has become somehow conflated with or interchangeable with far-right politics. And in fact, that's just an inaccurate use of the term. It just means an uprising on the ground, and that has happened on the left, too, and folks, some members of my family are part of that. So for my dad, you know, he's somebody who has worked hard, often right alongside black and brown people on construction sites, and, you know, being friends with or working with people of color does not preclude someone from racist thoughts or behavior. But it does mean, you know, an intimate understanding of the ways in which we share a common experience in, as the subtitle of my book says, working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth. And my dad is mad, yes, when there is this term, the angry white working class. For him, the anger is not at people of color or women whose progress he does not begrudge. It is toward corporations and just the centers of power in this country that he knows are underpaying him and his fellow laborers, and in making sure that they don't have access to health care. And he's suffering along the way. He's for things like a universal basic income and, like, wildly leftist ideas.
Really? Your dad for UBI? Huh. Mm-hmm. So in a political system, though, that is ruled by money, I mean, how much more work does it take for people who do not have much to, A, be understood better, and B, move forward together?
Oh, gosh. You know, it's almost impossible, to be honest, when you are living that life of just the day-to-day grind of labor and staying on top of just every aspect of survival that is kind of threefold in terms of energy input when you're poor. It's almost impossible in that life to have any sort of, to be engaged in civic action, to be, you know, even just go to a protest across town. Okay, maybe you have the gas to get there. And if you do, you don't have the time. And if you have the time, maybe like you need it to sleep or have a moment of rest rather than be engaged in trying to right the social wrongs of this country. So my awareness of social issues and my engagement in any sort of civic discussion is really, I understand, a privilege of a middle class I have found myself to be part of, that it's just about impossible to access, not for lack of interest or desire or good ideas, but just for lack of resources when you are struggling to get by.
And final question has to be a personal one, which is, was how the members of your family responded to the book and the portrayals of themselves?
I love answering this question because the honest answer is to me so sweet. My grandmother, in particular, she didn't want to read the book until it came out. She gave her blessing all along. She's one of my main interview sources. And the first thing that she said to me after she read the book was, in spite of all of her own hardships that are documented, she felt bad for me as a little kid that I struggled the way that I talk about in the book. So it was a very selfless response, and that's my close family members are all very proud of the book.
Well, we get to love them by the time we're done with the book. The book is called Heartland, a memoir of working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth. It's the work of Sarah Smarsh. Thanks so much for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thanks, Jeff. This was great.
Take care.